I do not see the road open for public travel for probably the rest of the week.
Severe flooding closes the Taylor Highway, stranding motorists. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 13th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Coast Guard pays tribute to the three members who died in a helicopter crash last week.
When we do have a loss of any one Coast Guardsman, much less three, it really touches the lives of all of us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
Much of the Taylor Highway remains closed due to flood damage. A vehicle is submerged in O'Brien Creek, but rescue workers have not yet been able to determine whether someone is in it. Storms dropped between 1 and 4 inches of rain across the eastern interior in recent days, causing the 40-mile river to crest at a record 94.5 feet at the Taylor Highway Bridge yesterday. Levels on the 40-mile and its tributaries are now falling, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the high water has left sections of the gravel road in ruins.
Flood damage has shut down travel on the Taylor Highway from milepost 67 at Chicken all the way to mile 160 at Eagle near the Canadian border. State Department of Transportation TOC District Manager Dennis Bishop surveyed the situation from the air.
There's several places where there's small slides where the banks undercut the road, or some of the material has fallen down on top of the road. There are places where the culverts were completely washed out and the rivers are now running through where the road used to be.
Bishop says the worst road damage is from Chicken to mile 90, where water is carved back and forth across the highway in several places, including cutting a 12 to 15 foot drop off at Walker Creek near mile 80. He says there are also washouts at numerous locations to the north, including at American Creek outside Eagle. He says the damage is keeping some people from getting out, but no one is in any apparent danger.
When I flew over, I would say there was anywhere from a dozen to 18 vehicles along the highway. Most of the people out there were either minors and they have a place to be, or they were travelers with motorhomes and campers.
Bishop says state troopers have flown in, conducted safety checks, and offered to ferry out stranded travelers, but it may take several days before the road reopens.
I do not see the road open for public travel for probably the rest of the week. We're trying to get some of the stranded motorists out, so we're just putting in a very rough one-lane road just to get some people out.
Bishop says the road should be ready for public travel, including transit by tour buses, by next week, but that completing repairs will likely take the rest of the summer. Susan Wyron, who runs tourism businesses at Chicken, says high water damaged the bridge over Chicken Creek Sunday.
It was kind of phenomenal, and I took a walk down because Holland America was unable to cross the bridge at that point. They had two coaches that were coming in and traffic was stopped there. So I walked over the bridge and talked to them, and we ended up walking the 85 people that were on those two coaches across the bridge and up to the business.
Wyron says DOT shored up the bridge and got the buses across late Sunday. Wyron says while the road damage is slowing business, a few tourists are still making day trips to Chicken from the TOC side, where the Taylor Highway is open. She says an endless train of dump trucks are hauling gravel by Chicken to fix the road damage to the north. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Coast Guard is a family. That was the prevailing sentiment at a memorial service held this afternoon in Sitka for Lieutenant Sean Kruger, Petty Officer First Class Adam Hoke, and Petty Officer Second Class Brett Banks. The three Coast Guard servicemen died last week when their MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter crashed into the water off La Push, Washington. Coast Guard Commander Doug Cameron took command of Air Station Sitka just 9 days before the accident. He served with Banks and Hoke at prior Coast Guard assignments, and in his short time in Sitka, got to know Kruger as a model officer.
Sean, Adam, and Brett all loved their jobs. They loved being guardians for the people of Alaska. They loved the adventure of flying in Coast Guard helicopters, especially in Alaskan skies. And like all of us here at Air Station Sitka, they had a special place in their hearts for Sitka and its people. Sitka is our home.
Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp made the trip from Washington, D.C. to attend the memorial service. He spoke to reporters afterward.
It's such a small service by comparison to the others that when we do have a loss of any one Coast Guardsman, much less three, it really touches the lives of all of us. So that's why we gather together, why we take the time to do ceremonies like this. I refer to it as the manners of our profession, but it's really a time for us to get together, to celebrate the lives of these great heroes, and then to shore each other up to be able to get through the tragedy.
Today's memorial service was also watched online by more than 1,300 people. The survivor of the crash, Lieutenant Lance Leone, was released from a Seattle hospital yesterday after being treated for a broken arm and leg. State permits for the Pebble Mine will be challenged in court. State Superior Court Judge Eric Arseth has found the State Department of Natural Resources in 2009 issued permits for the mine without considering the mine's impact on public resources. The judge said that the state should have considered state constitutional issues before issuing the permits. The Superior Court action results from a lawsuit filed by Nunumta Aluxtai, a group made up of 8 village corporations in southwest Alaska. The lawsuit alleges that DNR issued the land use and water use permits behind closed doors in violation of the Alaska Constitution. Bobby Andrew is Nunumta Aluxtai's spokesman.
I'm glad that has happened, basically, because this is a constitutional issue. And Nunumta being the lead party to the suit, along with the other parties that are involved in it. My personal opinion is that it's going to make it a lot easier for the trial to go through. Now they can proceed, and with any other motions that may come before the judge, I'm sure those will be rejected after they start the trial in December.
Nunumta Aluxtai's goal is to stop the development of Pebble Mine, which is a copper and gold mine being developed near the headwaters of the Quijac and Nushagak Rivers, which are the largest sockeye salmon-producing rivers in the world. Opponents of the Pebble Mine claim that the open-pit mine will compromise the sockeye salmon resource and do harm to the Bristol Bay salmon fishery. Mike Heatwall, spokesman for the Pebble Project, says the implications of the judge's decision are under review.
Pebble is an intervener in this litigation between Nunumta and the state DNR. And I think one of the main issues that the judge put forward is that there are facts that need to be discussed in a trial. And that's what we're looking at now. And you're probably aware there have been several decisions and motions throughout this process since litigation was first filed. And it will probably continue as we work our way toward the December trial date.
Heatwall says Pebble exploration will continue for the present time. A trial is scheduled for December 6th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Aleutian Islands roots of the environmental group Greenpeace.
The concern was that the testing of nuclear weapons along the Aleutians might trigger another earthquake.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska did not fare well in a recent federal report on performance of American Indian and Alaska Native students. From member station KNBA, Jacqueline Estes reports.
The federal government continually assesses student performance and recently issued a report based on tests in 11 states with high populations of American Indians and Alaska Natives. In 2009, 10,000 students were tested in reading and math at the fourth grade level, and 8,000 were tested at the eighth grade level. Arnold Goldstein is Program Director for Design Analysis and Reporting at the Center for Education Statistics in the U.S. Department of Education. He says scores for Alaska Native and American Indian students in Alaska are low compared to their counterparts elsewhere.
Alaska's score was lower than any of the other states. Fourth grade reading did a little better in eighth grade reading relative to the other states. In mathematics, at grade four, Alaska was, again, not the lowest, but among the lower performing states, and also at eighth grade.
The Alaska Department of Education and Early Development has a range of initiatives underway to buck the trend, says Information Officer Eric Fry, but he says agencies cannot do it on their own.
You know, the state has a role, the districts do, the parents do, even the students play a role in education. So it's everyone working together.
Compared to their counterparts, white students in Alaska scored close to the national average, as did blacks in Alaska. Alaska Natives and American Indians scored about 50 points lower than whites in Alaska, out of a top score of 500. Goldstein said one group of Alaskans scored higher than similar populations in other parts of the country.
Alaska's Hispanic students actually scored above those for the nation, 215 versus 204.
I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Today, Amchitka is known mostly as a wildlife reserve, but in the 1970s, it was a cause. The U.S. government selected this island in the Aleutian chain as a nuclear testing site, and suddenly the place inspired protests and music festivals. Jim Bolin was a major leader in this anti-nuclear campaign and became a founder of Greenpeace. He died last week at age 84. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez tells the story of his trip out to Amchitka as part of its first Greenpeace mission.
Could contained underground nuclear tests be conducted with no hazard to off-island people and within the constraints of the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty? Could we support a test operation in the forbidding environment of Amchitka?
Nearly 40 years ago, a dozen anti-nuclear activists set sail to Amchitka to protest nuclear testing on the island. They called themselves the Don't Make a Wave Committee, and they wanted to direct the public's attention to the dangers of nuclear weaponry. Their halibut seiner never made it. But the committee did succeed in stopping the nuclear testing and in ultimately creating the organization Greenpeace. Jim Bolin, a founder of the Don't Make a Wave Committee, died last week at age 84. By 1971, nuclear testing at Amchitka had already become a cause. The U.S. government had conducted two nuclear tests on the island and were set to detonate more bombs. Steve Schallhorn, the CEO of Greenpeace Australia Pacific, explains why the nuclear testing got so much attention.
The concern was that the testing of nuclear weapons along the Aleutians might trigger another earthquake.
The area was already considered prone to earthquakes, and anti-nuclear activists expressed concern that setting off a bomb at Amchitka could trigger something like the 1964 Alaska earthquake. Traditional protests didn't seem to be having any effect, according to Greenpeace. The idea to sail out to Amchitka was casually brought up by Jim Bolin's wife, Marie. He then mentioned it offhand to a reporter, and suddenly the couple was committed to the journey. A concert in Vancouver featuring James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, and Phil Oakes raised money to lease the fishing vessel Phyllis Cormick, and a group of Sierra Club members embarked on a trip to the Aleutians to stop the U.S. government from conducting a third nuclear test on the island site. That 1971 mission was called Greenpeace. Despite the rough autumn weather conditions, the boat made it a third of the way down the Aleutian chain. But the campaign was put on hold when the crew was detained in Akutan and then taken to Sandpoint, according to Rex Weiler, a Greenpeace founder who knew Bolin in the 1970s.
The crew asked for permission to go into Akutan Bay, but they never asked permission to go ashore, and some of the crew members went ashore. And that was the pretense on which the boat was arrested by the Coast Guard.
Still, Bolin and his crew felt their campaign was working to change the attitude of the American public, says Whaler.
The Greenpeace crew received a message from the crew on the Coast Guard, and the message said, due to the situation we're in, we, the crew of the Confidence, feel that what you're doing is for the good of all mankind. If our hands weren't tied by military bonds, we would be in the same position you are in, if all possible. Good luck. We're behind you 100%.
Ultimately, nuclear testing was abandoned, and Amchika was turned into a wildlife reserve. The Don't Make a Wave Committee later turned into the environmental group Greenpeace. The expedition name had stuck. Before becoming an anti-nuclear activist, Bolin served in the Navy toward the end of World War II and passed through the Aleutians on his way to Japan, says Schallhorn.
I certainly think that his experience in World War II in Attu, you know, made that area of the North Pacific familiar to him, and probably made it a little bit easier for him to campaign and to actually take the Phyllis Cormac up to the test. In September of 1971.
While in Japan, Bolin worked on nuclear recovery efforts. Seeing the effects of World War II permanently changed his thoughts on modern warfare and how it was waged, according to Whaler.
The nuclear weapon issues was the one issue that Jim Bolin was just so serious about and so concerned about, and he felt that nuclear weapons were just an insane development in human history, and felt that they needed to be banned, and he felt that way his whole life.
Bolin later served as director of Greenpeace and wrote a book about his experiences. And while he couldn't get out to Amchitka on the Phyllis Cormac, another Greenpeace boat did 36 years later, finally completing Bolin's mission. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
The state says the proposed critical habitat designation for the polar bear could end up costing the oil industry, Alaska, and local governments hundreds of millions of dollars. In a recent letter to Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, Governor Sean Parnell says the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service grossly underestimated the economic impact of the designation because it didn't consider things like delays, legal fees, and lost jobs. The federal agency estimates the designation will cost less than $60,000 a year, in part because it doesn't offer any additional protections to the bear. Doug Vincent Lang is the state's endangered species coordinator. He says the state isn't opposed to taking steps to protect polar bears, but he says the critical habitat proposal doesn't make sense.
In essence, we believe that if measures are going to be implemented, that they have to provide some additional significant conservation measures. And to say that you're implementing these measures and they're not going to result in significant conservation measures perplexes us why, in first place, you do it. And second of all, you know, it really is irresponsible to underestimate the cost associated with that designation.
The state, along with Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, paid for an independent analysis of the economic impact of the proposed critical habitat designation. It's asking the Fish and Wildlife Service to redo the economic analysis and redraw the critical habitat boundary, which it says is too broad. Bruce Woods is a spokesman for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska. He says the agency is taking all of the comments it receives into account before writing the final critical habitat plan for the polar bear. He says the habitat designation is required by law.
We do believe that that there will be some benefits to the bear that will occur as a result of the designation of critical habitat, including just increased awareness of people that are going to be working in areas where the bears are.
The Fish and Wildlife Service hopes to release the final critical habitat plan in October. The polar bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 2008.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Wildfire smoke spread across Fairbanks today. The smoke is from the Willow Creek Fire, a lightning-caused blaze that's been burning across the Tanana River, 10 miles from town, for a month. It's been smoldering in recent weeks, but put up a towering column of smoke late yesterday. Fire Information Officer Sarah Sarlows says recent days' hot, dry, windy conditions have renewed activity.
The strong winds that we had in the last couple days basically woke the fire back up. But it is growing southeast, and so it's moving away from the Tanana River. And there's not a threat for it to cross the Tanana River at this time.
The Willow Creek fire was mapped at 2,900 acres last night, an increase of about 1,000 acres. The fire and another smaller blaze to its southeast are burning in an uninhabited area that includes military training lands. Anchorage Neighborhood Housing Services will receive a little over $7 million in two federal housing grants for the elderly and persons with disabilities. KSKA's Len Anderson reports on yesterday's announcement from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Affairs.
This is a special moment. It's a special moment for our organization. These will be the first grants of this variety that we will have applied for and received.
Brian Shelton Kelly is the real estate and asset development manager for the nonprofit corporation Anchorage Neighborhood Housing Services.
It's also, I think, an important and special moment for the community, for Anchorage. In the last several years, no one has applied for the HUD 811, the disability program. So that money's gone to other communities.
The combined total of slightly more than $7 million comes from two federal grants under the Department of Housing and Urban Affairs. One grant is $2 million plus for construction of 10 one-bedroom units for very low-income persons with disabilities. The second is more than $4,360,000 for building 20 one-bedroom units for very low-income elderly. Besides the construction funding, the two grants include additional money for rental subsidies.
In each of these projects, the future residents or future renters won't pay more than 30% of their income towards housing costs. So if someone's on a very low income or a fixed income, they may only pay a certain amount, like $100 a month, if that's 30% of their income, towards the rent. And the rent is set by HUD to cover the operating costs of the projects.
The rental subsidies cover 3 years and are $206,000 for the disabilities housing and double that for the 20 elderly units. Shelton Kelly says the federal definition for very low income in Anchorage for 2010 is $29,300 annually for one person. That amount increases according to the number of family members. Through a HUD grant awarded in 2009, Anchorage Neighborhood Housing Services has already purchased the necessary two parcels of land.
One's going to be located in Spinard, and then the other is the senior housing project is going to be located very close to Alaska Regional Hospital. We've been waiting on the announcement, and now that the announcement's been made, we can go ahead with design and get the projects ready for construction. And if all goes well, we aim to break ground next year, as soon as the ground allows us.
The competition for these low-income housing grants is considerable. Shelton Kelly says the Anchorage Neighborhood Housing Services bid was boosted by the support from several groups, including Catholic Social Services, Anchorage Community Mental Health, Access Alaska, the Disability Law Center, Alaska Housing Finance, the municipality, and the two local community councils in Spinard and Airport Heights. Some of these organizations will deliver services directly to the residents. Anchorage Neighborhood Housing Services plays more of a managerial role, making certain the units and residents meet federal requirements. The real estate and asset development manager says right now the nonprofit organization owns 950 units, mostly multifamily, multiple apartment housing, but also 120 single room occupancy units. That may sound like a considerable number, but Shelton Kelly says Anchorage is far from meeting the need for such housing, especially for low income people with disabilities.
The newest project to open in Anchorage, which just opened earlier this year, which was another 10 units, already has 10 people on the waiting list.
Anchorage Neighborhood Housing Services hopes to have the 30 new units ready for occupancy sometime after January 2012. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
two Sitka organizations have teamed up to foster sustainable economic opportunities in the community. They've jointly hired an intern to explore ways entrepreneurs can tap into money and expertise in the changing economy of the Tongass. From member station KCAW, Robert Woolsey reports.
The Sitka Conservation Society and the Sitka Economic Development Association might seem like strange bedfellows to anyone but Haley Sample. She works for both. Sample arrived in June, one of several current and former students brought to town by the Sitka Conservation Society. She says she was immediately singled out as a little different.
You know, when I arrived, I went to a city council meeting and said, you know, I'm the economic development intern, and one of the reporters came up and said, oh, you're the Republican of the group. And that's been kind of our framework is that, you know, if you support economic development, you're on this side. If you support environment, you're on that side. So I think it's really kind of reevaluating that definition and realizing that those can be mutually beneficial and that we should be both preserving our beautiful Sitka environment as well as really promoting, you know, our local economic development.
Sample has a master's degree in public policy and sustainable development from the University of Oregon. She most recently has been a policy analyst for the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance. Sample says she knows Sitka in the past has been polarized, and although she hasn't spent much time here, she thinks there's some movement towards smoothing over those old divisions.
I really see a renewed energy to kind of merge those two together. You know, I've talked to different city officials and different assembly members and different community members so far. And there's really this thought process of how do we protect our environment while being able to benefit from our environment? Because that's kind of our competitive advantage here in Sitka, is that you have so many natural resources.
Gary White, the executive director of the Sitka Economic Development Association, confirms that view.
A job's a job. You know, a job's a job if it's created restoring the forest or taking timber from the forest. It's a job either way, and that's our task, is to help create jobs in a business environment in Sitka. So we try to play with whatever cards are dealt to us and go to that end goal of job creation.
White says CETA is looking for ways to create local investment in Sitka. He calls it sustainable capital flow. He thinks if a mechanism is built, the money will come.
For instance, putting our 401k in mutual funds in New York City somewhere, maybe we could figure out how we can invest in our own community, keep some of that money here locally, and help develop a community for us, other than looking for our highest return, maybe as a mutual fund, maybe looking for higher returns here locally.
Sample says she'll be trying to plug the gap between traditional lending provided by five local banks and entrepreneurs who may not be loan-worthy in the traditional sense. Over the course of the summer, she plans to collect information in a blog, as well as steer people to resources that are already in place. One of her favorites so far is the Alaska Small Business Development Center in Juneau. Her goal, Sample says, tongue-in-cheek, is to leave Sitka with a big pile of money. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, and Jacqueline Estes, Len Anderson, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.